Good morning and welcome to Matinair on Air. Jane Matinair, Greg Buck, and Calvin Butenhoff. We are coming to you live from our studio in downtown Waukesha, where you can always join us. You can call or text at 855-752-4842. Leave a comment on the live stream if you're watching on Facebook, YouTube, and or Twitter. And if you have downloaded the completely free Civic Media app, you can call and text directly from the app to all of the shows across the Civic Media Radio Network. So go to your app store and download the free Civic Media app today. Busy show coming up today. Dan Schaefer will be here at 10:33 for the recombobulation area. And oh, guess what?
What?
There's a couple of referendums that are going to be placed quickly on the August ballot.
Oh, man, I'm so excited.
When turnout is low. And Dan is going to explain what these two referendum mean and what the implications would be and how this is going to help consolidate control to Wisconsin Republicans, essentially.
So they can do even less.
Pretty much. They want to put them in charge of money.
Oh, great.
And we're just going to, the governor is no longer going to be able to allocate where dollars should go. And we're going to leave it to the Joint Finance Committee because they're so efficient.
I'm surprised there isn't something there saying if you ever say the word diversity, you never get the money ever again.
Oh, just imagine.
Oh, yeah.
Of the ramifications of this. So Dan Schaefer is going to join us right after the 10:30 news to explain what is going to be on our August ballot. And this is yet another reminder, myvote.wy.gov. Get registered to vote. Make sure you're still on the voter rolls. If you aren't registered to vote, it would be a good thing to do that.
It's a good place and also if this kind of thing is starting to really, you know, raise your hackles, go to myvote.wi.gov. It will tell you who all of your representatives are, from the localist of local levels to the state to the federal. Write them a letter, give them a call. Always be respectful and nice, because,
please,
you know, the people answering the phone, they're not the ones you should be mad at.
No, they really aren't. No. I mean, I understand they're working for these people, but they're not the lawmakers and they're not the they're not the power brokers. So yeah, we just ask that. And I also think that you just lose credibility when you're insulting and use profanity.
Mm-hmm.
It's just me.
It's easy to hang up on someone when they're swearing at you.
It really is. It gives you kind of a justification for saying, yep, I'm not taking that. So
yeah.
That is coming up at 10:33. Today is Bring Your Dog to Work Day. So next hour, when we lighten things up a little bit, 11:33, we are going to be talking with the executive director of HAWS, Humane Animal Welfare Society here in Waukesha. And Maggie Tate-Techtman is the executive director. She will join us at 11:33 to talk about Take Your Dog to Work Day and also all the other things they have going on. If you're considering adopting a pet over the summer, maybe you don't want to adopt, maybe you want to foster.
Yeah.
Because they're always, always looking for fosters.
I couldn't foster a dog because I'd be like, oh, you're home. You're mine now.
You will never leave.
Yeah.
You are never leaving here.
Yep. Nope. That couldn't happen.
That's coming up next hour at 11:33. Big breaking news, though, this morning. Supreme Court issued its final opinion for today. No more opinions will be issued now until next Wednesday.
Okay.
The total immunity case for President Trump is still waiting and kind of hanging around there. And we'll get to that in a second. But today, by 8-1, the court upholds a federal statute which temporarily disarms people subjected to a domestic violence restraining order. Justice Clarence Thomas, of course, the only dissenter. Nearly 18 months ago, the Fifth Circuit, which presides over lawsuits in Louisiana, Mississippi, and Texas, vacated a law from 1996 which prohibited anyone under civil domestic violence restraining order from possessing a gun. And because of that, those federal protections have not been enforced in those three states, Louisiana, Mississippi, and Texas, ever since, which is not really an ideal situation for women and children who are in bad relationships with abusive partners. According to one person I saw on Twitter this morning, this case should never have made it to SCOTUS in the first place. Not only was the Fifth Circuit ruling absurd, but the defendant, Mr. Rahimi, has a very, very interesting background.
Oh, his story is, as told by the New York Times, too, the way they wrote his story is very, very New York Times.
Mr. Rahimi once fired a shot at someone who saw him shove his girlfriend in a parking lot and then threatened to shoot his girlfriend if she told anyone. He also fired an AR-15 into the home of someone who posted about him online. He shot at a driver after a car accident. He shot at a truck that flashed its lights at him on the highway. And he shot his gun into the air after his friend's credit card was declined at a burger place. He needs his guns.
Well, Jane, when the government tries to take over, he's going to have to be one of the people with a gun to help. Because, you know, you want that kind of mindset on the battlefield. My goodness, what are we doing? Why are we...
I don't understand how this ever got this far.
Yeah.
And I don't understand... Well, I guess I'm not surprised by Clarence Thomas's decision on this. But this is good, at least for supporters of domestic violence survivors and other organizations for women and children. I would like to think this is something that is not that hard to agree on, unless you're Clarence Thomas.
Well, also, unless you're some of the people who just do not care whatsoever in any situation. I mean, the same people who will side with Clarence Thomas are the same people who just have no problem when children are killed in schools, who think that a few sentences, two sentences in the Constitution supersedes, you know, the lives of tiny children, or, you know, just people in general. Very pro-life stance, I might add.
Oh, yeah.
They're, of course, going to come to... They might be holding their nose in defending Mr. Rahimi, but they're ultimately going to say this is a... This is... Because where does it stop, Jane?
Oh, I don't know. Keeping weapons out of the hands of violent criminals who are under a restraining order? I don't see why that's so squashing your freedoms.
Well, it is. And I can't explain it to you, but it is.
Because I just yeah. don't get it.
Yeah.
I just don't get it.
There are people out there right now who are enraged by this decision. They think that it's the government coming one step closer to taking their guns.
Well, I would think that the people who might be outraged by this decision are the ones who may tend to have violent tendencies in their interpersonal relationships.
Yeah.
That's just speculation. All right. I did want to share that.
I love the all right.
That's my all right. Let's move on. Yeah. We're going to do a brief segment we're calling Lawmakers Behaving Badly. I find this just remarkable. Seriously remarkable. There are a couple that we're going to talk about briefly. A state lawmaker from Vermont, Republican, has now apologized for repeatedly pouring water into a Democratic colleague's bag, but only confessed to doing it after he caught her on video.
So she's not really sorry.
She got caught.
She's caught.
She got caught.
Yeah.
State Representative Mary Morrissey apologized to State Representative Jim Carroll and the citizens of Vermont from the House floor on Monday. Quote, I am truly ashamed for my actions, she said, of her disrespectful conduct toward her colleague. She said she had apologized directly to Mr. Carroll and will be working toward resolution and restoration throughout the legislative process. Mr. Carroll told the Associated Press he hangs a tote bag in a hallway at the State House, which I'm sure a lot of them do.
Yeah.
And it was soaked a number of times per week in January and February. So he would come out after doing whatever it is that he does and he gets his dope bag and it's soaking wet.
Yeah.
Doesn't know what's going on. He doesn't have anything in there that's leaking. He doesn't, you know, what is happening? Then he did get charged with driving under the influence in February. When he got back from rehab, the bag was soaked almost on a daily basis. And he couldn't figure out what was going on. How is this happening? So he put up a video camera on the opposite wall and captured Ms. Morrissey pouring water from a glass into his bag. He finally showed it to the House Speaker, who confronted Ms. Morrissey. This is a disturbing situation at odds with our legislative practices. The integrity and decorum of our legislative proceedings are of paramount importance. Morrissey now facing an ethics investigation. She was taken off of a key committee. She hasn't said why she did it. Quite honestly, quote, I don't know why I did it. I was not meaning to hurt Jim. It was something very out of character for me, and I'm ashamed of myself. You did it for months.
Yeah.
Several times a week, and then almost daily. Oopsie. Oopsies.
I'd like to go back and see if there's any sort of squabbling on the floor, like, or dissenting between the two of them.
I don't care.
I mean, I don't. No, I don't care. I just would love to know where one day she just looked at that tote and said, "I'm gonna fill that with water.
I'm gonna get you.
I'm gonna get
you. I'm gonna get you."
It's such a weirdo way too. And this whole thing of, you know, I'm so ashamed. I'm so sorry. No, you're not.
You got caught.
You got caught. You would keep doing it if you you hadn't. So don't act like all of a sudden you've come to Jesus. I'm so sorry.
I'm so penitent now.
Yeah, and also this whole like the decorum of the legislature is paramount.
Well, what are you, 9?
Yeah.
I'm going to get you
with
a glass of water in your bag. I mean, granted, this wasn't a violent action, but it just is petty, and I would think beneath the behavior of a state-elected representative. But apparently not.
No.
Apparently not. I'm sure she'll get reelected handily.
Yep.
And
quietly put back on that committee.
And start dumping water in other people's bags. One real quick. Another Republican in the news from Lansing, Michigan. Republican state lawmaker arrested after a disturbance early Thursday morning. Representative Neil Frisky, 62, was arrested around 2:45 Thursday morning. Officers were sent to the area responding to reports of a male with a gun as well as possible shots fired. Turns out that Mr. Frisky, a first-term Republican, was chasing a stripper outside of his house with a gun.
As you do.
I guess. His arrest stems from allegations he sexually assaulted an erotic dancer and then chased her down with a firearm. What really blows my mind with this is his representative says, quote, "As many of us know, Representative Frisky is always exercising his Second Amendment right to chase a stripper who rejected you." Okay.
Yep.
Guess that's just fine.
Proves my point.
We're all 9.
Yep.
Coming up, welcome to 7th grade.
Oh, boy.
Stay close. You're listening to Matt Nair on Air. This is the Civic Media Radio Network. And welcome back to Matt Nair on Air. Jane Matt Nair, Greg Bach, Calvin, coming to you from our studio in downtown Waukesha, where you can always join us. You can call, you can text at 855-752-4842. Leave a comment on the live stream if you're watching on Facebook, YouTube, and what used to be Twitter. We did have a question on the live stream, Greg.
Yes, so Sherry from Horicon did ask us a question, which I'm going to answer for you right now, which is, where do we sign up for your show as a podcast and give you 5 stars?
Oh, great. Thank you,
question, Sherry. We love you. We love hearing from you. Hello from Waukesha to Horicon. Now, first, what you're going to do, everyone, is you're going to go to your phone, or if you go to your device, but most likely your phone, and you're going to go to your podcast distribution center of choice, whether that be Apple Podcast. Google's no longer around as far as their podcasting, but you can go to Podcast Addict, Podbean, Libsyn. There are a lot of places where you can find a podcast catcher. Go to the one. Find it or go to the one you use for your podcast. Just type in Matt Nair on Air. Now, if you don't know how it's spelled, it's MATENAER on Air. Matt Nair on Air. You're going to find us. It's a nice cloud. It's a clouds with our name right there. You can't miss it. You're just going to click on there. You hit subscribe. And then you can also probably get the option to automatically download new episodes. And you'll get 2 a day from us because the show is broken up into two hours.
Right.
2 hours. 2 podcast episodes per day, and that way you can then listen to us on the go. If you miss an episode, you don't have to miss anything. And then you're also able to review in app, so you can hit 5 stars if you think we've deserved it.
Don't give us pity stars.
Yeah,
looking for pity stars.
If it's anything below 5, then please send all questions, complaints, comments to, and write this down to Calvin at the Butenoffer slash.
Underscore.
Slidey McGee dot Angel Fire.
There you go.
All those go to him.
Goes right to Kelly.
And we'll get back to you someday. But yeah, just go to your podcast distribution center of choice, download the podcast, review it in app, hit 5 stars if we deserve it. We loved it. And those 5 stars actually help other people find the show.
Right.
And if you like other shows in the Civic Media universe, do the same.
Absolutely.
But it's an easy way to take us with you wherever you go.
Thank you for that nice encapsulation, Greg Buck.
I try.
All right. We don't have a lot of time to talk about this, but I think it's important to mention. Pastor Robert Morris, pastor at a Texas megachurch who also served as a spiritual advisor to former President Donald Trump, has now resigned after confessing to a moral failure about 40 years ago after a woman accused him of repeatedly molesting her as a child. Cindy Klemscher telling NBC News that Morris was staying with her family in 1982 when she was 12. And he was 21 and said he invited her back to his room where he told her to lie on her back and then he felt her up. And she said this is the first of a number of encounters that spanned over the next 4.5 years. She remembered him saying, "Never tell anyone about this. It will ruin everything." She finally came forward. This took decades. Sounds like other church leadership knew about this and did nothing. And then I saw this, which just about put me over the top. Barbara Phillips Littlepage is also a minister, apparently, in the South. And she posted this. "I want people to not judge Robert Morris because of a mistake he made over 30 years ago. Some young girls at 12 years old are very beautiful and sexy." She's 12. "They don't understand how men are made, and young men don't understand their actions are being used by the devil to ruin the future God has for them." So, again, this seems like blaming the victim to me because she was 12 and she was apparently quite sexy. And the other thing that grinds me about this is that when Robert Morris finally admitted to this, he said he had an affair with a young woman. She was 12.
She was a girl.
Yes, she was a girl. A 12-year-old is in seventh grade.
I think, for me, the only thing worse than the defense of this, what was her name again, who defended her?
Barbara Phillips Littlepage.
Is the fact that she invoked holy destiny in its defense. This is, of course, you know, men are made differently. I was 21 once. I stayed clear of any sort of situation like this because I didn't think that was morally right, nor am I the type of person who wants to do that. Like, there's so many reasons why I wouldn't do that. But the fact that he did that, 9 years older than her, she's 12, and then says, "Men are designed for Satan's use." What was it again?
"Girls don't understand how men are made, and young men don't understand their actions are used by the devil to ruin a future God has for them."
Yeah, it's that, too, that really makes me even more angry, is that she didn't just defend him. She defended him by saying this would ruin his life and God has a plan for him.
Right.
And this is, you know,
not this that this is going to ruin her life or affect her life at all.
No, no, not the mountains of therapy she would have to go through. Because who knows if she even remembered it or probably stuffed it down or maybe thought it was her fault. I mean, when you say this will ruin everything, I mean, I could ramble about this for hours, but it's just the absolute audacity. And then people have the nerve to say things like, you know, trafficking is a terrible problem in this country. It absolutely is.
Absolutely.
But when we don't hold consistent our rage in our beliefs and you are allowed to just give someone a pass because of, I don't know, God, that is the most infuriating and also takes the wind out of the sails of the argument. It just makes me think you don't care that much about it. If you're going to defend a man for molesting a child, then you can't convince me that you believe so much in these problems. You believe in them because they're fashionable right now. It's easy to say child trafficking is a terrible problem. It very much is. But what are you doing about it? You're defending a child abuser.
Well, he was a man of God now, and that was a long time ago, Greg.
And Satan was in charge of our bodies, apparently, because they're trying to get after our godly destiny.
And also, the victim, Ms. Klemscher, said also that Morris claimed he apologized to her father.
Oh, yes, that's
not
right.
Not her.
That's right.
And she said he never actually apologized to her father or her, but he went and apologized to the church elders. It's infuriating.
He should be in jail.
12-year-old girls can be very beautiful and sexy.
Disgusting. I can't. There's, oh, God. And please, is this sexist what I'm about to say? Coming from a woman saying that.
Oh, that's even worse.
Okay.
That's terrible. It's terrible. She was 12 once.
Yeah.
All right.
Whoa, two all rights in one half
it's
hour.
Just that kind of a morning so far. Dan Schaefer.
Don't worry, dogs later.
Dogs later, dogs later next hour. And Dan Schaefer is coming up. After the 10:33 news, some, I will call them sneaky referendums, making their way onto the ballot in August when fewer people are expected to vote. We're going to have all the details about that with Dan Schaefer from the Recombobulation Area coming up next. Stay close. You are listening to Matt Nair on Air. This is the Civic Media Radio Network. Welcome, welcome to Matt Nair on Air. Jane Matt Nair, Greg Box, Sweet Cal B on the board coming to you from our studio in downtown Waukesha. You can call, you can text, it's the same number, 855-752-4842. Leave a comment on the live stream on Facebook, YouTube, or what used to be Twitter. He joins us every Friday at this time from the award-winning Recombobulation Area. Dan Schaefer is here. Good morning, Dan.
Good morning, Jane.
Well,
happy to be here.
When I saw your column yesterday, all I could think of was, this seems sneaky. And I'm so suspicious. I know that's wrong of me. But making this rushed effort to get these two referendum on the August ballot just seems, to me.
Yeah, it's a perplexing one.
Hmm.
And I think you're correct to raise some alarms here about having a provision on the August primary ballot that would amend the state constitution. So we published this piece yesterday at the Recombobulation Area, not by me, actually, written by Phil Rocco of Marquette University. So he really breaks down what this question is that's going to be on all of our primary ballots in August and what the implications of it would be. And that the stakes of this are huge.
Yes.
For governing in Wisconsin.
Yes.
Basically the questions are more or less asking if any federal funding that would come to Wisconsin would require legislative approval. Now, this could snarl things in a variety of ways. But one of the examples that Phil used in the piece here was talking about, you know, a disaster situation or an economic downturn situation
or a global or a global pandemic, perhaps.
Exactly. So we of course saw that in 2020 when, you know, a lot of federal funds were distributed to states around the country to address the pandemic, address the recession that went along with it. Basically, you know, we had a situation where Tony Evers was in charge of the federal funding that was coming through. This would change that and basically make it so that the legislature would be in charge and of certain federal funding here. And of course, we had a situation in 2020 when the legislature was the least active full-time legislature in the country. So do we really need to be putting more barriers in between the governor's ability to govern in a crisis? Maybe, maybe not. But I think these referendum questions, these constitutional amendments that are going to be on the ballot in August, raise a host of problems if they were to pass. And as we saw in April, when some of these very confusingly worded questions were on the ballot in the April primary, these do often pass once they do clear all the hurdles necessary to be on the ballot. So this is significantly concerning. I think the Wisconsin Democrats have come out against this. I heard a couple of speakers talk about this at the WISDEMS convention in Milwaukee a couple of weeks ago. I believe Cavalier Johnson raised some red flags about this because I think it would also kind of impact the relationship between federal funding going from, you know, the state to various municipalities and counties as well. So this really could open up Pandora's box of problems. And it's happening in Wisconsin for this August primary for the first time in the state's history. We've never had a constitutional amendment on an August partisan primary before. And turnout for this particular partisan primary is projected to be very low.
Yes.
You know, we don't have a competitive statewide primary, you know, unless a challenger jumps in against Eric Hovde at the very last minute here, which I don't anticipate happening, you know, there's really not going to be a real primary like we saw a couple years ago with, you know, Tim Michaels and Rebecca Clayfish, or in past years for other gubernatorial or Senate or other statewide races as well. So, you know, the turnout for this is kind of the decision on this is kind of going to depend on places that will have primaries. So that would include, you know, a couple congressional districts do have competitive primaries. The third congressional district has a couple different Democrats running. The eighth has a few Republicans running to replace Mike Gallagher. But this is not a situation where there is a lot of statewide attention being paid to this particular primary, and to have the constitutional amendment land at this particular time raises a host of questions, and I think is pretty problematic.
It seems very intentional.
It does. And I think this is just the path, you know, in the last 6 years since Tony Evers defeated Scott Walker, Republicans have, you know, used every lever of government that they can to continue to tilt things in their favor, whether it's through gerrymandered maps, whether it's denying appointments, whether it was the lame duck session immediately following Evers' election. And so I think this, you know, is part of that story from the past 6 years where Republicans are kind of skirting the traditional process. Because if they wanted to pass this, as they've done with so many other bills, you know, it would run into the roadblock that is the governor's veto. And so they're trying to use this mechanism to, instead of finding some sort of compromise, go around that and take these confusingly worded questions directly to the voters and at a time when turnout is going to be super low. So this is, you know, just your latest example of Republican shenanigans in the state legislature.
We had Deborah Cronmiller on from the League of Women Voters talking about this, and she said that, you know, putting something on the Constitution generally is like should have more weight to it, or is a last ditch effort. Whereas right now, it just seems like they go right to the Constitution. And if you look at the Wisconsin Constitution, the amount of repealed or rescinded, whether it's amendments or sections, is just as long as what's on there, which makes it look very embarrassing. The fact that we really just, you know, we treat the Constitution like, you know, let's put it on there. Well, let's just get rid of it. It's not how it's supposed to work. They're going right for the Constitution versus like accepting the L sometimes, which they will never do.
Well, and this again just seems to me more evidence that they're still, their fifis are still really hurt that they lost, that Scott Walker lost to Tony Evers, And then to have Justice Janet elected by such a wide margin, they just can't accept that. And they know better, Dan. They just know better. And for people who are listening and thinking this is not a big deal, if you live on French Island, if you live in the Chippewa Valley where those hospitals closed, if you want something done about PFAS in all our communities, you know who's sitting on that money? It's the Joint Finance Committee, and this is who they want to give power to determine where these federal dollars should go. Is that accurate?
Yeah. Yeah. This is, you know, there's another case happening regarding the kind of the separation of powers in the state right now, about, you know, some of these committees and whether they have final approval over certain projects and whatever. But I'm going to read to you one part of Phil's piece here. Says, in other words, suppose Wisconsin experiences a natural disaster and economic crisis, or as happened in 2020, both. The federal government rushes aid to the state. Under current law, the governor would be authorized to accept these unanticipated funds and allocate them to impacted businesses, communities, or individuals. If the amendments contained in questions 1 and 2 pass, the state legislature would be able to insert itself into the process, preventing the governor from allocating the funds until the legislature approves.
Which could be never.
And it could push this approval process into some of these unaccountable, lopsided representation committees, like the Joint Finance Committee, which right now I think is 11 Republicans to 4 Democrats. And so even if you have a situation like the, you know, if all 4 Democrats are opposed, you still might have all of the Republicans kind of taking over the process. As earlier versions of this proposal explicitly stated that this process might include a, quote, joint committee of the legislature. So they're trying to push everything into these unaccountable, undemocratic committees of a small number of legislators. So it's not even the full, it might not even necessarily mean a full floor vote, depending on the how the lawyers interpret the final meaning of this. It's just... again, it is this legal Pandora's box that is being opened with these constitutional amendments. And again, the turnout for this is supposed to be low, projected to be fairly low. If you look at the 2022 midterms, just 27% of voters participated. And that was actually a 40-year high.
Oh, my gosh.
So, we're going to be making this decision on the future of the state constitution based on a very small number of Wisconsin's voters.
Well, and I just see them using this method also to do what they pulled. I mean, even in Joint Finance Committee, do what they pulled with the UW system. It says, okay, you want your money? You have to rescind, get rid of, take care of a program we don't like because we find threatening to our whatever freedoms or whatever makes us get all, you know, upset. And, you know, we can't say it goes the way of Florida, where we're no longer to say words in our laws. We're no longer able to do anything, because if you do that, they'll take away your money. It's going to get really, really petty real fast.
And again, if you are frustrated with the fact by how little they have, the legislature has accomplished in the last decade, this is only going to make it worse. That just means they can sit and sit and sit on these funds in the middle of a pandemic, in the middle of a global recession, and then go on vacation.
They're going to bump it up.
And then take another short session and be off for 10 months.
I was going to say, they're going to bump up to 11 months this time.
And they deserve it.
Mm-hmm. And I think too, it's worth considering that, you know, we're going to have fairer maps going forward. So this, you know, the entrenched power of the Republican gerrymandered majority is not going to be the same as it once was. So perhaps this is an example of a last gasp of that gerrymandered legislature trying to push something through in a way that they probably would not be able to do in the future because of the majorities. But I also think this is, even if the parties were flipped here, I don't think this is something you want to take away from the governor. I don't think, even if it was a Republican governor, I don't think these are powers you'd want to take away from them, because you want your elected governor to be able to act in the situation of emergency. Even if it's somebody I disagree with, they, you know, the governor is elected by the entire state of Wisconsin, and that person should be able to act in an emergency situation.
And I think it's important that people look back at what Tony Evers did with that money, because it went to small businesses in Wisconsin. It went to businesses that depend on tourism that were just decimated during the pandemic. And if you were one of the recipients of that assistance, that might not happen if this passes. So we would be vote no on both of these. Am I correct, Dan?
We would be vote no on both of these. Yeah. Another example, the group, the Main Street Alliance, which works with small businesses, voiced their opposition, noting that the speedy approval of federal emergency funds were critical to the survival of restaurants, bars, and shops during the early days of the COVID pandemic. So this is just adding another legislative hurdle to being able to, another thing put in between, the governor and governing.
And getting something done. Yeah. And getting something done. We are going to keep hammering this until August, because again, this just dropped. We just found out about this. This is very, very important. Myvote.wi.gov. We need big turnouts, not just for the August primary, but certainly in November. Please get involved in the process. It is critically important. We are going to continue the recombobulation area with Dan Schaefer. He had a long sit down with U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin, and we will talk about that coming up next. Stay close. You are listening to Matt Nair on Air. This is the Civic Media Radio Network. Signs and welcome to Cleveland.
Hoping for a relaxing weekend. Once I get strapped in the 210, wheels up and we'll be rocking. Getting out of frozen Wisconsin. I need you to recombobulate me. I want you to recombobulate me. I need you to recombobulate me. Won't somebody recombobulate me?
Good morning. Welcome back to Matt Nair on Air. Jane Matt Nair, Greg Bach, the Calvinator on the board, coming to you from our studio in downtown Waukesha. You can always join us. You can call. You can text. Same number, 855-752-4842. Leave a comment on the live stream if you're watching on Facebook, YouTube, and what used to be Twitter. If you want to catch baseball, you can catch baseball tonight. The Brewers at the Padres, 8 o'clock game. Catch the game on News from the Center, WRCE in Richland Center, and Oshkosh Air Support, WISS in Oshkosh. Again, Brewers Padres tonight, starting at 8:05. He joins us every Friday at this time from the award-winning recombobulation area. Dan Schaefer is here. And Dan, you had a chance to sit down with U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin for a pretty long conversation this week. What did you all cover?
I did, yeah. I thought it was a great opportunity to have some independent media interview interviewing Wisconsin's only senator. Tammy Baldwin.
Oh, shots fired.
the interview we conducted was last week. And the day of it was very interesting. If you happen a chance to take a look at the interview at all, there was we started by talking about childcare, and we started talking about childcare because the senator, they have I get the advisories from her campaign team as well as her Senate team. And of course they're not talking to each other because that's how campaigns work. And so I got an advisory from her Senate team saying that she was going to be in Milwaukee at a childcare center on Monday Monday afternoon. And I was like, well, my interview's on Monday afternoon. I'm passionate about childcare. Maybe I'll go check out this event and roundtable that she was hosting with childcare leaders. When I looked at it, it looked a little closer. It was the childcare center that we have been sending our daughter to for another year.
Oh, wow.
Wow. That's so amazing.
It was quite the coincidence, I think, just to have that opportunity. So I got to, you know, go in not as just one of the dads in the pickup line, just to put my professional journalist shirt on, to go through and tag along for the tour with the senator. And I thought it was, you know, a coincidence, but also kind of not a coincidence. One of the things that Tammy Baldwin wants to do is she wants to meet people where they are. And, you know, after all, I'm a dad concerned with childcare costs.
Yep.
So maybe it's not that big of a coincidence that that is where our paths would cross, all interviewing and planning and recombobulating aside. Right. And so I thought that was interesting. And then, you know, we talked about childcare. We talked about, you know, what they have been doing, at the federal level to steer more funds, toward, childcare in the most recent budget. Baldwin talked about just through moving things around, they were able to direct another $1 billion, towards a childcare grant, you know, without any new funds at the federal level. But she also talked about, and, you know, said that this is childcare is a system that the free market doesn't work for childcare. And we're seeing that over and over where, you know, the people working there aren't paid what they're worth for those jobs, and the costs for parents is too high. And so it is just a broken system. So we, had opportunity to talk about that, but we touched on a whole variety of things, throughout the 35 minute, interview that we had, with Wisconsin's only senator.
We had an opportunity to have her on as well this week. And one of the things we asked Dan was just about, what do people say when she's out and about and talking to people? And I'm always impressed by, it seems her, with her ability to connect to just Wisconsin folks, no matter where they are in Wisconsin. It could be farmers, it could be union workers, it could be bridge builders, it could be childcare workers. And I really do think that she has a good ground game with that.
Yeah, I asked her a question about that too, because, and I quoted someone that I don't really often or ever agree with. I quoted Robin Voss.
Oh my gosh.
What?
So in the 2021 public hearing on redistricting, when Voss was introducing maps, he referenced Tammy Baldwin's victory in 2018 a number of times, saying that Tammy Baldwin is able to have a message that connects with rural and swing district voters in a way that legislative candidates weren't. Now, I think he was saying this because it's politically advantageous for him to have gerrymandered maps, and that's what he was advancing at the time. But I think there's a shred of truth to it too. Baldwin does do better than a lot of, you know, other candidates in rural or swing districts. One of the examples that I always use from her victory in 2018 was that in the Fox Valley, she won Winnebago, Outagamie, Brown, and Door counties, and so did Scott Walker win all four of those counties. So Baldwin can win in places that Republicans do better at. And so I asked her about that, and her answer was pretty simple. She just said, I try to show up everywhere. And when I show up, I try to listen. And so I think that's really ultimately the type of senator that Tammy Baldwin is. You know, there's some senators that will get up on the stump speech and deliver an inspiring speech, and she can do that, but I don't think it's her hallmark. She can, you know, there are some senators that might be you know them because of their ideological views, Bernie Sanders, strong progressive, you know, whatever it might be. And I think for Baldwin, the hallmark, I think, is constituent services and showing up wherever she's called to and answering every call and trying to show up and to listen.
When
I think that's what we gathered from our interview with the senator.
When Todd Alba and I were on the road last week doing parts of Western Wisconsin, and he pointed out that Senator Baldwin had been at a dairy breakfast in the area at the same time that Lake Sinning axe throwing California guy Eric Hovde was supposed to be at some meet and greet after a fundraiser in Oconto, and he was caught by someone on a beach in California.
Exactly.
Huh.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, that was, she did talk about her opponent too, and drew some of a contrast and talk about how she's out there working for hardworking Wisconsinites, and Hovde is a little bit more in tune with the well-off in Wisconsin and California.
And he also has no platform. He has no positions. It's except for he's really good with platitudes. Well done on the platitudes, Eric. There's no substance there.
I take issue with that. I feel like Eric has really come forward and he wants to know what the people think about his mustache. So,
well, If that's not the issue that all of our lives hinge upon, I don't know what is. Subscribe to the wonderful award-winning Recombobulation Area. Dan Schaefer, thank you so very much for joining us. We will see you next Friday.
Thanks for having me. Be well.
Stay with us. News is next. You are listening to the Vast Civic Media Radio Network.